Hi, everybody. My name is Mary Emma, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. Grateful to be sober today. And Dick, thank you for that introduction. You know, I live in Hilton Head Island, South Carolina today, and I've been there for about 14 years. But I got sober here in Atlanta, Georgia, on June 10th of 1978. And I walked into a church, actually. It was called McElroy. But any of you who happen to be Atlantans, I got pretty much sober at Skyland and around the city. And John and I met at Skyland and started dating. And usually we do talk about, you know, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. But tonight I'm going to just talk a little bit about where I am right now, because I've, as Dick shared, I've come through a bit of a rough patch, and it's more than a rough patch. John and I were married for 33 years, and he was my soulmate for 35 years. And, you know, one of the things that I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is that we just keep putting one foot in front of the other, and when we're asked to do something, we do it. One of the things I wanted to say, though, you know, a lot of my friends have been saying that I have come through this illness and John's death with grace and dignity. We, you know, we use that term a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, moving through whatever the tough time is with grace and dignity. And, you know, I don't know how graceful I've been. I don't know how dignified I've been. But I have been clean and sober through John's illness and through his death. And the only thing that I've had to take the edge off my life has been the love of this God who has empowered me beyond my human capabilities. And he is the God that I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am forever grateful for that. It's just been, just to let you know a little bit about what Dick was talking about, John celebrated in April his 56th year of sobriety, and he was a man that was very loved here in Atlanta. We were here, he was here from 71 until 2002, and we were a couple here for 24 years. And on June 10th of this year, which was my 37th birthday, John said, you know, I'm not feeling so good. We had company, and he said, I'm not feeling so good. I'm going to go take a nap. And by the next morning, he was delirious, and I called 911, and he ended up in the hospital. And not to go into all of it, but for 3 weeks, he battled a blood infection that he had gotten. And, you know, really all my life was for those 3 weeks was going to the hospital, being with him, being in ICU, and then coming home and praying. And there were nights that I was just on the floor praying that God would bring him through. And I was sending out these texts to all of our friends, you know, telling them all the good things that are going on, and then, you know, saying, pray that he's going to have the strength to get through this. And I found one of those texts recently where I said, would you please pray that John has the strength to get to the other side of this? And what I realized was he did get to the other side of it. It just wasn't the side that I thought it was going to be. And so that was June 10th, and on July the 6th, which a lot of his guys, you may remember that we had the International here in Atlanta. That was a big thing. We were so excited about going to the International, and when everybody showed up here for the International, I was saying, send me pictures, I'm going to make a slideshow. And some of his guys said, you know, John was a gentleman to the end, because on the Monday morning after the International was when John went home. And they said, you know, he was a gentleman to the end. He didn't want to mess up the International for anybody. So, and that was, that's kind of, and so that's what's happened. And what has happened for me, you know, I just went into a cave of grief. And it was like this deep, dark cave of grief. And I was licking my wounds. And, you know what? Alcoholics Anonymous starts pulling us out. Alcoholics Anonymous has been here for me from the day I got here. And one of the things that happened to me after John's death, and I told you I was 37 years sober, it was like I was a newcomer again. I would get out of my car, and I would go into my meetings, our meetings, and I would sit. And all I could do was sit. All I could do was cry, and everybody in my meeting just loved me. You guys loved me when I got here 37 years ago. You've loved me today through the greatest pain that I've ever experienced. And for that, I'm truly grateful. And I'm grateful for the life that I've been given here. And you know, one of the things that happened, and then I'm going to actually tell you how I got here in the first place. About 3 months after John died, I got a call from these young girls over in Charleston, and they asked me if I would come participate in their meeting. And it was a women's retreat. And I said, you know what? She called me. This little girl's name was Brittany, and she was the chairperson of this women's retreat. And she said, ask if I would come do it. And I said, you know, I just don't have anything to give. I just lost my husband. I just really want to come, but I just want to kind of savor what everybody else says. And she was so sweet, and she was understanding. And so we hung up. And it was like the second I got off the phone, I'm hearing God, right? I hear God talking. Mary Emma. It's like he said my name. Mary Emma, do you think that I would have brought you through your whole life and through these last three months and that I would drop you when you have a chance to be of service to someone? And so what happened was I called her back. I went to the conference. And, you know, that's what's happened. I said, once again, just like the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous on June 10th of 1978, finally I said no to me and yes to God. You know, we come here with this shattered ego, and what a gift. We talk about the gift of desperation, but I am really grateful for that shattered part of me that was so broken that it allowed the grace of God to come into my life. And he did it back then, and he does it for me today, over and over and over again. And I'm so grateful for that. Just to tell you a little bit about me and where I come from, I'm a Georgia girl. I grew up in Cochrane, Georgia. So I'm a Georgia peach. And I came from a small town. Any of you who are Georgians may know of Cochrane. If you go down to Savannah, you see that there's an exit for Cochrane, Georgia. It's a very small town. We had a junior college there. And so I grew up in this small town, and my mother was wonderful, but I had an alcoholic father. Although I didn't know him, when I was 3 and my brother was 4, what I think happened was she had always been the one that was the worker. My father was the dreamer. He was the drinker. You know, he had the big plans, and she was the one that went to work every day. And so when I was 3 and my brother was 4, what I think happened was that she decided she could only take care of 2 kids, not 3, but 2. And so she said goodbye to my father, and he said goodbye, and I never saw him again. He went out of our lives, and so I never had another contact with the man, with my father. One of the things that I think for my mother was, you know, the idea of alcoholism, and we didn't have any in our immediate, except for my father, whom I didn't grow up with, so I didn't grow up with any alcohol in the house. And I think my mother had this idea that if, you know, there's no alcohol in the house, then I don't have to worry about my kids. I'm going to show them the way to live, and everything's going to be fine for them. Well, when I was 15, I had my first, and now we'll just jump right into the drinking. I had my, to tell you a little bit about what I was like before I ever drank, thinking about my high school, and some of you may relate to this, you know, the music. I think about the music that I played, and it was all the Maudlin, you know, James Taylor, although that's not Maudlin, I still love that today, but all of the sad, I'm a rock, I'm an island, you know, all of those songs that absolutely separated me from everybody else. And so those are the kind of songs I like. But I was in all the clubs at school. I did everything that I thought that she wanted me to do. Also, I had my grandparents in the town, so I had a very strong nucleus family, you know, a very strong family that loved me and took care of me. So when I was 15, I had a chance to have my first date. And it was now this is kind of interesting. I had my first date, and this was a double date. And I got to go on this double date because the girl that I was with, her mother was a friend of my mother's. But she was a year or so older than me, and we went out on this date, and I'd met this boy at church who was from the college, from the junior college there. And we went out, we went to a school dance, and during the break we came out, and of course we had everything that you need, your drinks, whatever, and this was in the early, actually it was the late 60s, probably 69, 70, because I graduated in 1971. And so we went out during the break in this dance, and this girl and her boyfriend knew each other a lot better than we knew each other. In fact, they knew each other so well, it was embarrassing. You know, we were so naive, we didn't know what was going on up there. Well, we knew what was going on, but we didn't know how to handle it. And so, you know, we start drinking, and all of a sudden, the alcohol starts taking over, and it feels good. And that very first night, I got drunk. They had to take me somewhere so they could get water on my face so they could get me home. And that was my first drinking experience. I never drank socially. I never drank well socially. You know, it was from the very beginning. It was like I took the drink and the drink took me. There was just something about it. It was also the first time that I ever felt a little freedom. You know how, for me, how we get here and there's this separateness and this differentness that we have from other people. And there was something about that little bit of alcohol that kind of made me okay with me and made me a little more connected to you. And so it was a comfortable feeling, and I liked it, and I started pursuing that. And I started getting into trouble. I'd been in a lot of clubs. I'd been a cheerleader. I'd been in lots of high school clubs, and also work. I always worked. I always had a very strong work ethic. But I started getting into trouble. I started being the girl that when we'd have parties and go to somebody else's house, I was the one that they would have to throw into the shower to get her sober enough to get her home. There were no treatment centers in Cochran, Georgia, I can promise you, in 1970, 1971, but I started changing everything about me, the way I looked. You know, we were wearing Bobby Brooks skirts and little matching tops and all of that, and then it goes to the denim, the blue jeans, the split jeans, anything that I knew would get on my mother's nerves, that's what I was going to wear. And so that was the way it was. And one of the things, the way I could tell you about how my mother dealt with me and my shenanigans in high school, I like to say I was grounded my whole senior year of high school. That was kind of the way she dealt with it. She didn't have any other place to send me. She didn't have any other way to take care of me. And she knew that I was getting in trouble. But, you know, if you go to church a little bit more. And by the way, I went to church every Sunday. It didn't matter where I was on Sunday night or on Saturday night or Friday night. I was going to be sitting in church on Sunday morning. That was just the way it was in our family. And I will say that I had a really, really strong connection with this God of my understanding. I had this, I knew that God was with me. I had already begun blacking out. I already had begun getting into places and finding myself in situations that I had to try and get home. When I ended up going, I did graduate from high school in 1971, and I went to school at Middle Georgia College for a couple of years. And then I went to West Georgia College in Carrollton. And my third year in school, I was a junior in college. My grandmother started calling me and telling me that my mother was ill. And I was in college during, you know, the crazy times, the drugs, the drinking. The biggest thing that we did in college when I was in school was we tried to make sure that we got all of our classes after 12 o'clock. You know, you went to as few classes as you could and had really bad grades, but I loved being away from home. I loved not having anybody around me because I always felt that my mother really just kept me under her thumb. Now, as I look back on that time in my life and I look at the girl that I was, the impulsive, compulsive, obsessive, ADD girl that I was, I needed somebody to have their thumb on me. I needed somebody to be taking care of me and telling me what to do. Undisciplined to the nth degree. But my junior year in college, my grandmother called and said my mother wasn't doing well. And I came home to take care of her. She ended up with cancer. She had lung cancer. And she was to die the very next year. Within that year, actually. And the reason I share this with you was because this was a huge change in my life. The person that I had done everything in my life to try and, you know, she was the one that was my discipline. And then when she was gone, there was no discipline. There was no one that was ever going to tell me what to do again. You know, we don't like to be told what to do. And so I ended up going about my merry way. I was a junior in college. I one of the things I did was I had come home to Cochran, Georgia, to take care of my mother. But you know, one of the things that happens with us, we go home with really good intentions. And as she was getting more ill with her cancer, I was ramping up my disease of alcoholism and drug addiction, and I was finding my connections, and I was, you know, doing the things that I needed to do when I would get home, and the ambulance had been there. They had been called by the neighbors. It was a really tough time for her, and I really didn't have anything to give her. So that was our relationship. This was the woman that I loved more than anybody, but I just couldn't be there for her. That I had gotten myself so disconnected. And you know, there is a thing about this disease of alcoholism. It disconnects us. We come here separated, not able to be connected to anyone. At least that's the way it was for me. And it's been through doing these steps that you guys have given me. It has been through working these steps and beginning to be willing to take the wall down one brick at a time that I had a chance to start connecting with people here in Alcoholics Anonymous. After her death, I went to Atlanta, and I ended up finishing my college education. But you know what? There's one thing to have a piece of paper that says you can do something, but then having the ability to do it, those are two different things. And I ended up going out to Southern California. I got a job with a company in Atlanta, and I went and I was working out at the University of Southern California, out at the Museum of Science and Industry. And I lived on the USC campus, and so I'd walk through their campus every day. And you know, one of the things about being in Southern California, it is a lot different from Atlanta. And I want to tell you something about the way my drinking usually began. Because, you know, when I got here, and the conventional wisdom about alcoholics was that you drank and drank and drank, and then you crossed that invisible line. And it was usually a man. You know, that's what I thought of as alcoholics. I thought alcoholics were middle-aged men who had drunk themselves into alcoholism. Well, so how could this young little 18, 19, 20, 23-year-old girl be an alcoholic? I can't. At least not by conventional wisdom. Of course, today we don't think about that at all, but I promise you, in the 1970s, I just didn't look like your average alcoholic, but my behavior was very much like that. But living in Atlanta, I always had a way to get home. You know, I always knew how I could either call somebody to get me home or I could get a cab. But when I came to, I knew how to get back to where I lived. And then here I am out in Southern California in Los Angeles. There's something about Southern California. You can start drinking in one part of the city and you can end up 35 miles away and not know how you got there. At least if you drank the way I did. You know, once I started drinking, and you know, the big book talks about that thought before we take the drink. For me, my thought before the first drink was always, I'm getting ready to have a good time. That was how my drinking always started. I'm just starting tonight. You know, we'd start as a young girl or a young woman out there working. We'd start at 5 o'clock. We'd put the music on. We'd start the drinks. And then we'd go out and we'd look for a good time. And that was kind of the way my drinking was. I wasn't one who drank every morning because I was desperate. But once I drank, once I started, I could not predict how my evening was going to end, where I was going to end up, who I was going to end up with. Once I took the drink took me. And I hear us talk about king alcohol. And that is absolutely, it became king in my life. When I was in Southern California, one of the things that happened, and I told you that I started finding myself, and not just embarrassed, you know, when you're a drinking woman and you're a woman who blacks out, it begins with being embarrassed. You know, I found myself in situations that were embarrassing to be in. And then they move to situations that are dangerous. And then they end up in situations with, how can this continue to happen over and over again? And I remember being out there, it was 1977, I was 24 years old, and I had met this woman that worked with me at the Museum of Science and Industry, and she really had it together. And I'd been out there for a while, I'd probably been out there 6 months, and I had found myself in more and more scary situations. And one of the things about that time in my life, in the 70s, if you were a young, cute, blonde, the consequences weren't necessarily so bad if you could kind of keep the rest. the car in the middle of the road or in the middle of your lane. You know, I seem to always be able to dance around the consequences that a lot of other people today, when I think about kids and what gets them here so soon are the consequences that they have to deal with. And I didn't have any of those consequences, but the consequences I was dealing with were the guilt and the remorse and that looking at myself in a mirror and the demoralization that we talk about. You know, just that accumulation of demoralizations. And one morning I woke up, one more morning after one more night before, that I had started off in one place and I'd ended up in another. And I couldn't look at me anymore. You know, you look in the mirror and you see those dead eyes. You just see, oh my God, how did I get here? How did I get to be this person? And for just a moment, that brief moment of what I think is grace comes in, it's like, I can't live this way anymore. I didn't have any treatment centers. I had actually, over the last 3 years of my life, I had separated myself from my family. I'd moved to Atlanta. You know, after my mother died, they would call and say, you want to come for Thanksgiving, Christmas? No, I've got to study. No, I've got car problems. And then the next year, no, I can't come this year. And then I moved 3,000 miles away. So I come from a great family, but I was totally separated from them. I was tired of disappointing people. I didn't want to disappoint people. And so that's how I found myself out in Southern California. And what happened on this morning, there had been this woman at work that I knew, and I know it sounds like, you know what, I must not have had too many consequences that I had to deal with, but it was just, my life had just become something that I couldn't recognize. I couldn't recognize the person I'd become, and I also was starting to project the person I was going to become. And it's funny today because I thought, I don't want to be that 50-year-old woman at the end of a bar, you know, with a cigarette hanging out of her mouth. Or I'm not going to live through this. You know, when you're a blackout drinker, every time you come to it, it's like, oh, thank God I got through that one. Today I laugh when I say I couldn't see me as a 50-year-old woman. Well, today I'm much farther along than a 50-year-old woman. I'm really grateful for it. But I saw this woman. There's this woman that I'd gotten to know that I worked with, and I was telling her, I decided, and I didn't let too many people know me. The way I got to know people was when I went into the bars, and I love the bars. I love going out. I love looking for a good time. I maybe would go with a couple of people, a couple of women, but I liked looking for a good time. And but this morning it was like I couldn't live this way anymore. It was that little bit of message that God gave me, you know, when the brain's just going around and around and around and the thoughts are going around in the mind. And I thought, I can't live this way anymore. Well, I didn't know anyone to call. I didn't know about treatment facilities. But I went to work that day and I told this woman that I worked with that I thought, you know, she's got it together. She looks good. She's got a nice car. And her name was Barbara. And I asked her if she would go eat lunch with me, and we went out to lunch really right there at the museum. And I don't know why I decided to tell her that I thought I had a drinking problem, but I told her, I don't know what's wrong with me, but it seems like whenever I drink, I can never tell you how my night's going to end. And once I start drinking, I can't stop. And we kept on talking, and she was asking me about, you know, the situations I was getting into. And I said, I can't stop. I don't know what to do. I don't know who I need to call. I don't know if I need to call a doctor. I don't know what I need to do, but I cannot stop. Because every night, after every day that I would say, I'm not going to do this, and we constantly do that. I'm not going to do it again tonight. I'm not going to do that tonight. And all of a sudden, tonight comes, and the music starts at 5, and we start the drinking, and we start the dancing around the apartment, and then it ends badly. And I'm telling her this, and I'm telling her about the things that are going on in my life. And she said, you know what, I think I know somebody that might be able to help you. Now, when she said that, I'm thinking, okay, there's a person, there must be some kind of therapist around here, somebody that's going to give me the word on how to not live the way I've been living. And she said, I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 5 years. And her husband, she and her husband were both in AA. And the thing that was really weird is I think back on that time, they didn't even go to AA anymore. She said, well, we don't really go to meetings anymore. We really don't need it that much, but I'll take you. So she took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for the next 6 months, and I went to meetings with her, and in Los Angeles, in Southern California, those are some big meetings. They are big. It's a big place to try and get sober or to try. You can really blend into a crowd out there. And I started going to meetings with her, and I mean, these were meetings where people would, they would have like a podium here, and people were vying to get up to the podium. And one of the things that I found out about me is that as soon as I started taking the alcohol out of my system, the more withdrawn I was. And you know, the other thing about when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and today I hear a lot of kids talking about studying the big book, studying the 12 and 12, listening and, you know, being inspired by people. I don't remember all that. I just got there and I just sat. I really wasn't able to read the big book. I really wasn't able to read the 12 and 12. I didn't even really hear what you said, but there was this essence of hope in that room when I would sit down. And I knew that this is the place I needed to be. You know, all the rest was going to follow, but this is where I needed to be. And so I started coming to meetings when I was out there. And she became my temporary sponsor, so maybe it got her back into the program for a little while. But I started going to meetings out there, and then I kind of liked it. I loved the energy. You know, I was young. I loved the energy of young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came here as a young person. I loved everybody going out to places after the meetings, and so I liked all of that stuff. I didn't know about doing the steps or any of that. You know, I wasn't really that willing to change me, but I did like what you guys were doing. And I knew that it was good because I wasn't going out drinking every night. And I was there about 6 months, and the job that I had ended, and I ended up coming back to Georgia. Now, I'll tell you something about living in Southern California. In fact, I just got back from there. I literally flew in here tonight from Laguna Beach. I've been out there for a couple of weeks with another friend in my program, Tom Whalen. He was another one of our big guys who in his area just passed away, and she and her husband and John and I had traveled for 25 years together. So I was just out there with her and going to all these big meetings. But so what I was going to say about Southern California is it was just different. You know, it was a different lifestyle. And even though I enjoyed it, I'm a Georgia girl, I'm a Southern girl, and you can take the girl out of the South, but you can't take the South out of the girl. And, you know, that was just kind of the way it was. I was glad to get back home. And I started going to meetings here, and I came back to Atlanta. I came back to Atlanta, Georgia. And this had been in 1977 that I came in first in California. So I came back here, and you know the thing, I was going to meetings. I don't know if anybody here has moved in sobriety, but you know, whenever you move, it's like they just don't do it right. They just do it different. They don't do it the way they do it where I got sober, which must be the right way. I got to tell you a story that my husband used to tell. I loved this. He got sober in Southern California, and he ended up being transferred to Minnesota. He went to Janesville, Wisconsin, and he was like 8 years sober, and he was up there, and he hated the meetings up there, and so he called back to his sponsor, and he said, "Howdy, I hate the meetings. I hate the way they're run here. Nobody goes out and talks. They just come into the meeting and they leave." And Howdy said, "John, was there anybody sober in Janesville before you got there?" And he said, "Yeah." He said, "Okay, well, then it's working for them." So that's kind of the way it was for me. You know, I got back to Atlanta, and they didn't do it the same way. But I went to my meetings, and one of the things that happened for me and one of the things that I know about me today is I was willing to give you a little bit of me. You know, I was willing to come to the meetings to sit down, but I wasn't really willing to get a sponsor or really willing to do all the work. The only thing I had done when I first got here was put the plug in the jug, and I heard this thing about it's a spiritual program and the healing is spiritual. And one of the things that happened for me was I started kind of easing away from Alcoholics Anonymous and seeking more in the church, seeking more of a connection in a church that I was going to. And I always like to share this part of my story because I do believe, and I absolutely believe, that God is the answer, that God heals, and the spiritual healing that we get here is from a God who I've said has empowered me beyond my human capabilities. But I ended up going to church more, AA less, and all my church friends knew that I didn't drink, and so I'm pulling away from AA, and one of the things that happened almost a year to the day, I run into some old playmates that had been friends of mine here in Atlanta, and I pull up to the stop. Now, this was a sign anyway. I pulled up to a stoplight, and I look over, and I see an old roommate, an old party friend who's sitting over in the car next to me, and she said, "Hey, it's my birthday. You know, we're going to have a party." And so I just got an apartment, and I said, "Why don't you come over to my house, and we'll have the party here." Now, I haven't had anything to drink for 1 year. And even in church, they drink wine. I mean, you can drink wine. So this is the way this alcoholic thinking is. I went out before everybody got there, and I got not just one big bottle of wine. You know, do you know the big gallons that you could put your thumb through? I got two of those. And I took them home, and I drank one before anybody ever got to the house. And you can get drunk on wine, but wine for me, and that was what I'd given up. That's I decided to give up all alcohol but wine, but for me that was always the gateway drink, right? That it just began the evening. And then you would go to the bars and drink everything else. But that night, all these old friends came over. I remember starting drinking as the night goes on. And then what happens, we go out to the bars, and I remember going to one bar. And the very next morning, I wake up, I'm in my apartment, I am alone, which was great, and but it brought back every single feeling, and it confirmed everything that I had confirmed a year before. You know, the way that I couldn't drink the way other people drank, all of the feelings that it brought up in me. You know, I'm really grateful today that I didn't have one glass of wine that night and then had another glass of wine and then another glass. I never drank that way before, and so why would it be that way now? And so that morning, I wake up, I come to, as we usually do, and I am not just mortified, it's just, I can't believe this has happened. And the person that I ended up calling, somebody that I was really close to, was my pastor. And he and his wife were a young couple, and I went over to see them, and one of the things he said to me, which I thought, today I think that's really telling, he said, "Miriam, did you ever think that maybe God wanted you in AA, that that's where you get to go, that those are the people that know you, those are the people that have the answer for you?" So I said, "Yeah, I guess you're right." So one of the things that happened, and I was so mortified, I was sick, I was heart sick, I was soul sick, I was like, okay, I'm going to do this thing the way it's supposed to be done. And so that's when I ended up back here in the meetings on June 10th of 1978 in McElroy. You know, that was in a church, and it was like the iconic AA meeting. You went down into a basement. Everybody smoked. So the whole basement was filled with smoke during that time. And so I went in, and I get sober. I put the plug in the jug. I start asking people to be my sponsor. And you know what happens? I start going to different... Atlanta's a big place, so you can ask someone to be your sponsor and then just go to another meeting. You know, you don't really have to get connected to them. So that's kind of the way that worked. And I ended up sitting in AA meetings. And the reason I share this with you is, you know, God in His wisdom will give us what we need, whether we are willing to take it or not. You know, He continues to be here and to be present and to present to me the things I need. And during that first year, after I was 6 months sober and I was going to these meetings, Skyland and McElroy, and there was this guy that starts kind of following me around. In fact, I would be working and I would be running down the road at 12 o'clock and he would drive up and I'm thinking, "Who are you?" And he was a guy from the meeting and starts pursuing me. And you know how that AA boy meets AA girl on AA campus happens around here. And, you know, I didn't know anything about relationships. And so this guy, we start dating. And by the time I'm a year sober, I'm married. And by the time I'm a year and 3 months sober, he's moved me to Florida. And he comes in one day. It's, "Oops, I made a mistake. It's not you, it's me." And I leave. I left the very next day, and I know that sounds unbelievable, but you have to remember, I know nothing about relationships. I've never seen anyone in my household in a relationship. And my attitude was, okay, if you don't want me around, I'll leave. So I came back to Atlanta. One of the things that did for me was it made me realize how even in sobriety I was so sick. And I was so unwilling to listen to anybody, to do what anyone told me to do. I wasn't willing to do the steps. I wasn't willing to become the person that I could become. I mean, I didn't know I was doing that. But I got back to Atlanta. I got a sponsor. Her name was Debbie Fegan at that time. It's Debbie Davis today. And in fact, she still calls me today. 37 years sober, and my first real sponsor still calls me today on every birthday. And we went through the steps, and I do have to share with you, when I looked at the steps, I knew I was crazy, I knew I was powerless over alcohol, and there was a God that was going to restore me to sanity, and that I would turn my will and my life over to the care of God. But the idea of doing an inventory, I mean, I'm Southern. We have a lot of pride. We don't share our stuff with anybody, you know? But one of the things Debbie did was she said, okay, let's do this fourth step because this is where the healing starts. You see, I hadn't really understood a lot about what the steps do. I had not been willing to pull all of those six secrets out and to look at them and to share them. And Debbie said, okay, I want you to do your fourth step. And every week she would say, are you ready to do your fifth step? Are you ready? Are you ready? And I kept saying no. So she finally said, okay, next Sunday at 5:00, I want you to come to my house. And that's the way we did my first fifth step. And I was always that way in college. You know, it was the night before. You had to be backed up against the wall. The pain had to be excruciating before I was willing to do anything to make it better. Today, I hated pain. You know, that was probably one of the things I loved about alcohol, was I loved not having to feel. So I did my inventory with her, and we ended up going through the steps, and I got a couple of sponsees. And during this time, and I'd always been working, I'm going to meetings. By my second year of sobriety, John and I start dating. And another thing that happened, I was working and the woman that I worked for brought me into her office and she was offering me a higher position, a promotion, if you will. And I remember sitting there thinking, there is not one job in this company that you could give me that would make me, that would fulfill me. And I had, you may have been there before, you know, that just that thought that there's nothing that I can do here that's going to make me feel good about myself. And it was at that moment that I had this thought that there's more for me out there as far as my career goes. And I had a chance to start applying for school. I had no money. I saved $1,000, and that was like the most money I had ever seen, you know, at one time in a long time. And I saved it to go to school, and I started applying for grants and at Georgia State University. And one of the things about applying for grants and for school at that time was there was no Google. I mean, you had to write them. They had to send you the application. You had to fill it out. You had to sit in. You had to be patient. Well, that's another issue that I have is impatience. But I had a chance to get back to school, and I went back to school in education. And by 1982, John and I had been dating. We dated 2.5 years. And I like to say 1982 was a stellar year for me because that was the year I started my career. I started my career as a teacher, and that was the year I also married John H. And, you know, we were to walk this walk together, and I had a sponsor, and I was willing to do the things you had told me to do to feel okay about myself. But you know what? One of the things that happened to me, and this happens a lot, and I see it in women that I sponsor today, and it was definitely my experience. You know, there's also this part of me, because we talk a lot about putting everything spiritual first and then all of the other stuff follows. Well, you know, society is different from that. Society says if you have an education, if you have the job, if you have the relationship, you know, with women it's like if you have that man or that relationship, that's when you're going to be happy. And at two and a half years of marriage with John, everything looked great. We'd moved into a brand new home. 2 years of this wonderful career, 2 years of being married to this man that was loved me. You know, we did. We had a very loving, kind, caring relationship. I mean, he loved me more than I ever had been loved in my whole life. And you know what starts happening at 2.5 years? Now, 2.5 years into the marriage, I was 6.5 years sober, and I am like a cat on a hot tin roof. I am walking around getting antsy, picking fights, getting into behaviors that I had been in, you know, bouncing checks, doing things that, you know, John's like, what are you doing? What's going on? I didn't know. You know, I didn't know what was going on with me, but I just knew that I was uncomfortable. I'd begun actually dreaming about the fact that I needed to leave, that I needed, and my dreams always had me in Alaska alone. I'd always been a vagabond. I was one of those people that if you had my name in your address book back when there were pages, right, that you would have my name, my address, that would be marked out, and then another address, marked out, another address. I mean, I was a vagabond. I was much more comfortable moving around and leaving than I was staying put. And, you know, John's saying, I don't know what's going on, but I can't live this way. Well, on that day that we're standing in the kitchen and all this is going on, I'm getting ready to go to a women's retreat down in St. Simon's. This was a women's retreat before Ladybug, but I was going down there with some girls. So I get in the car, and these girls and I go down there, and, you know, the whole time I'm thinking, what do you mean you can't live like this? What does that mean? So I get down there, we get to the retreat, the spiritual retreat, right? And so I call John, we're there, and I call him and said, what do you mean you can't live this way? And he said, I can't live with somebody that's, I just can't do that. Does that mean you want a divorce? Well, no, it doesn't mean I want a divorce. It means you need to get your act together. So I get home, and one of the things that happens, I'm making this really light, I promise you, it was much heavier than this. But I get home, and I am still having all these feelings that I'm talking about. And one of the things that I realized was that if I'm not the problem, there's no solution. That, I needed to leave. I felt that I needed to leave. I felt that that was the thing for me, that no, I can't do this relationship thing. I don't know how to do a relationship thing. I'd never seen my mother kiss a man. I'd never seen my mother have an argument with someone and then reconcile. I mean, how do you have an argument and then you get to the other side of it and then you're in love? You know, how do you do all of that kind of stuff? And what happened was I did. I had heard you. You said it. If I'm not the problem, there's no solution. And I ended up at 6.5 years sober in therapy with this woman that absolutely seemed to understand what was going on with me. And here, I'm going to therapy because I'm thinking I have a problem with relationships, right? With this relationship. I think it's the relationship with this man. And she throws me into this group and everybody starts talking about the things that are going on with them. And the thing that I came to find out about me, and this is long and convoluted, but it was not the relationship that I had with my husband that was the issue. It was the relationship that I'd had with my mother that was the issue. And it was the things that I'd done in my life. You know how we talk about the amends? And I had made a lot of amends to a lot of people, to my grandmother, you know, to the girlfriends who, I'm sorry I stole your earrings, I didn't have them with me that night, I'm sorry I stole your boyfriend, you know, those kind of amends that are just really light and no substance. But the thing with my mother, she had been dead for many years, and I didn't really even think about it. But one of the things that happened with me is we started looking at this issue with the relationship that I had had with her. And remember, I'm telling you, I think I need to leave because all of these things that you tell me are not giving me joy. The relationship, the work, the career, all the things that should be bringing me joy are not bringing me joy. And what I came to find out through the help of this woman, And I don't always recommend that people end up in therapy, but I could not bring it up in AA. I could not bring this stuff up with a sponsor. I didn't have the ability to do it. But what happened was it had to do with, you remember I was telling you about when I'd gone home to take care of my mother and that she would need me and I couldn't be there for her. And I had this unbelievable guilt and remorse. And it was as if I were wrapped in this cocoon of unworthiness. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that my life was filled with this unworthiness, that no matter what happened to me, no matter who was in my life, I couldn't feel it. I couldn't experience it. You know, how many of us get here and we have been loved and loved and loved and we can't feel it? You know, we feel separated. And what happened was we ended up doing an amend. I said, well, how do I do this? She's not here. So we wrote her a letter. I wrote my mother a letter about the things I had done, about the things that I wish I had not done, and also about the things that our relationship and how it hadn't been what I had hoped. And I was going to go to Cochrane. I hadn't been to Cochrane in 15 years. And I went there with my grandmother. I thought I wasn't going to go with John. I had all these plans about how I was going to do this amend. And the reason I want to share this about this amend, it didn't go at all like I thought it would. We got there, and one of my mother's old high school mates was there, and he sees me. Remember, I told you it's been 15 years. And he comes over, and he starts talking to me. And so all the time that I was going to be doing this amend and reading this letter to her. I also have my grandmother out here in like 100-degree weather, and she's 94 years old. So I'm thinking about her, too. So what ends up happening is I run over to my mother's grave and I just basically say, Mom, I'm so sorry. I love you. I'm sorry about the things I did. And then I run off and I said, will you forgive me? And I have to jump in the car and I leave. And that's the way that amend went. It wasn't anything dramatic. It wasn't this wonderful, oh, the weight of the world's lifted off of me. But what I want to tell you is what happened, that over the next few months, the spiritual healing had started. That healing of it is a spiritual healing. You know, we come here with these broken hearts, and it's only a spiritual healing that can heal us. And what happened for me was over the period of the next few months, I was able to start feeling again. Or I didn't know it was feeling. What it really was it was connecting. I was able to start connecting with the people around me, with my sponsor, with my husband, and I was able to slowly but surely take these, you know, I had this wall around me when I got here. And you break that wall down by taking out one brick at a time, and that's the way that worked. And John and I ended up continuing on and having a wonderful relationship. You know, one of the things that I loved about him was I'm the Southern girl, and he was a Yankee. He was a Pennsylvanian, and, you know, those guys will tell you what they think. Southern men are, I know we have some Southern men in here. I don't mean this any bad way. But, you know, we're pretty, Southern men are more laid back. You know, they're not quite as, I'm going to tell you what I'm thinking. Well, John was one of those who would tell you what he was thinking. And, you know, we would get into these little tiffs or whatever, and I would totally shut down. I was one who always shut down in an argument. I would shut down and withdraw. And he would say, don't you shut down on me. I want you to tell me right now what you're thinking. And, you know, we built this relationship of this man pulling me out of myself and helping me mature in the relationship and to learn how to tell you what I'm thinking without blowing up. You know, that's the other side. You keep stuffing, 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 and then you blow up over nothing. So our relationship was wonderful. It was a work in progress. You know, relationships don't happen overnight. People don't have a great relationship just because they're in love. Marriages have a lot more to do with commitment than agreeing on everything. And that was kind of the relationship we had a chance to build over the years. And I continued to work. And then in 2002, we moved to Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. And I had loved AA up here. I loved AA in Atlanta. But when I got to Hilton Head, one of the things that I loved and I love so much today is their absolute love and immersion in the Big Book and in the 12 and 12 and the literature. I happen to be an English teacher, so I love words and I love literature. And I've, you know, the idea that the Big Book is so inspiring, that it inspires, and that I can read something today and in next week it's going to mean something different. Or I read the Big Book 5 years ago and I look at a passage from it today and it's different because of my experience and what I've brought to it. And I love that about Alcoholics Anonymous in Hilton Head Island in Bluffton. And we have a really small, intimate community down there. You know, that's another thing. It's very intimate. You can't hide from people down there. You know, you're there and you're going to meetings. And I continued my working, and when we moved to Hilton Head, I ended up, my last 9 years of work, I was driving over to Savannah, so I drove 100 miles a day, actually. And this is kind of funny. My 29th year of work, of teaching, I was looking at my next year, you know, looking at the retirement and how I'm going to do all of that. And I wouldn't have retired, but when you're driving so 100 miles a day, I was kind of ready to be on the island. But I'm looking at my retirement and the retirement package, and what I find out is that I have a year of sick leave when I'm 29, have worked 29 years, and I have a year of sick leave. And this friend said to me, you know, you can take that year of sick leave. Now, the first thing I want to say is, what alcoholic do we know could ever accrue a year of sick leave? I mean, what, you show up, you go to work every day. I mean, who would have thought? And that's what you guys taught me to do. And so I ended up teaching 29 years, and so for the last 4 years, I've been on Hilton Head, and I've had a chance to really reimmerse myself in Alcoholics Anonymous. I always went to meetings, but I couldn't go to that many. John, one of the things about, I couldn't go to that many because I, you know, it was just a job that when you're teaching, you're pretty busy most of the time. So I had 1 foot in Savannah and 1 foot in Hilton Head. Also during all of this time, John and I did a lot of stuff in AA. We went to a lot of conferences. We went to a lot of conventions. In fact, this last international was really the first one we missed since 1985. So, you know, it was a big thing for me. But we've had a chance to go all around the country in Alcoholics Anonymous, and to meet people all over the country and in different parts of the world in Alcoholics Anonymous. We've done a lot of trips out of the country, and we always go to meetings. I love to see what meetings are like in other places, not just in another country, in another state, you know, just how people do it. But I am just so grateful for what you guys have given me, that you have opened up my heart. You know, we come here and we're so closed and we're so disconnected. And we think we're coming here to stop drinking. You know, that's all I really wanted when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want to live that way anymore. I didn't want to be that way anymore. I didn't have any plans about my future. You know, I didn't have any plans about a future husband. I certainly didn't have any plans about a future career. I just wanted to stop drinking. And here, as I stand before you, it has been, you know, phenomenal. But what is really phenomenal is the way I get to work with the women, and I get to see the change in their lives. I get to see the light coming on in their eyes. And when they're working on something, you know what? I am really grateful that even today, I try to still be humble. I try to listen to what our young people have to say. I try to listen to what the newcomers have to say. You know, I don't want to be this person that thinks I know it all. One of the things I love about Alcoholics Anonymous is I love the experience of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't want to just go to meetings. I want to experience meetings. We have my home group. I just want to tell you a little bit about my home group because it's kind of interesting. It's a Tuesday night women's meeting, and it is called the Tradition Step Speaker Big Book. And then if we have another week in the month, we have an 11th step meeting. So by the end of 12 months, by the end of a year, you've gone through all of the traditions, all of the steps. You have heard someone share their experience, strength, and hope every month. And we read stories in the Big Book. It is a meeting that at first when I got there, I didn't like it because I never knew what was going on. Like, what are we doing tonight? But it is a meeting that we don't, and we really work with newcomers. I mean, our greeter has a packet of newcomer information. So, I mean, we pretty much make sure you at least have a sponsor, even if it's a temporary sponsor, when you leave that night. So it's, you know, really strong recovery where I'm from, and I appreciate them. And I just, you know, I always want to be open to what God has for me through you people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I always want to be just a member. It doesn't matter how long we've been here, we each have just today. And I'm just really grateful to Dick for asking me to do this, you know. That was a text. I forgot to turn off my phone. You know, one of the things that happened was I was sharing with you that I've just been in this cave, this deep, dark cave of grief over losing John, and where I am today. I'm in a really good place, and it's because you guys just keep asking me and participating and, you know, just saying, come on, Miriam, I go to a meeting. You can sit over there and cry. We don't care if you sit over there and cry. Just come to the meeting. Just come. And that's kind of the way it's been. And you know where I am today. It's a very sweet place. I am looking with joyful anticipation to whatever God has in store for me. You know, I don't know what it is. But I know that with you guys, that I can feel joy today. I can feel the love that you have for me today. And if you're sitting out there, and if you're new, and you know, and if I haven't said anything you can relate to at all, don't worry. Just keep coming back and come to a meeting tomorrow, and come to another meeting. And you know, when I was a young person, and I'm going to end with this because I got to share at Skyland a few weeks ago for Robert K., who celebrated his 40th AA birthday. And Robert Kay and I were young people together in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we were in this crowd, and we were wild. We got kicked out of Denny's. We got kicked out of Coco's because we were too loud. We didn't put enough tips there. But you know what? We were passionate about staying sober. We were passionate about it. And so Robert asked me to come speak for him. And so then when he got his chip, he said, Miriam, we got kicked out of the AA club. We got kicked out of NABA. Our young people's group got kicked out of NABA. And when he got his chip that night, he said, do you know I was the secretary of that group, and I still have that letter that says on this night, you know, you'll be somewhere else. And that was the Northside Young People's meeting. And they are still around. I hear the laughter, so that meeting's still around. But, you know, I think about that, and what I think about is how crazy we were as young people. But there were so many of us are still here, and what we got was the essence of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is the hope, and that is what you have, that each of us has that hope. And, you know, this weekend is going to be powerful, and that's really the reason I came. I really wanted to be here this weekend to see Bob and Linda and some of the other folks here that I love, and, you know, that I wanted people to see that I'm okay. You know, that we go through this, but we can be okay. And being clean and sober does not always feel good, but we can make it through with the help of each other. And I love you. And Dick, thank you for asking me. I appreciate it. Love ya.